introducing tonight's program, a few words about the New York Society Library. We are one of the oldest libraries in the country and the oldest in the city, founded in 1754 by a group of civic-minded people who believed that creating the, quote, first public library would be very useful as well as ornamental to the city. The intervening 259 years have made the library one of New York's enduring institutions and cultural oases. Unfortunately, our membership fees cover only 22% of operating costs. How better to support the library's wide-ranging and ongoing services and programs than to contribute to the annual fund? Donation cards are available on the table immediately outside the room. I'm Jenny Lawrence, a former trustee and member of the library, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce Benita Eisler this evening, who is also a former trustee and a longtime member of the library. Benita grew up in the city, and after a BA in French literature from Smith and an MA from Harvard, she returned to New York as a producer for WNET-TV and then taught literature at Princeton before settling into her writing career. More than 40 years ago, just after her daughter was born, when she was working as a translator, Benita discovered the library. She would hire a babysitter and race down 79th Street, quote, listing with the weight of what was then considered a portable typewriter and the uncut pages of the French book I was to translate, heading for the large study room, unquote. Since then, she has spent most of her working life in the library, researching and writing 8 books, most recent the subject of tonight's talk, The Red Man's Bones, George Catlin, Artist and Showman. From her first books, The Lowell Offering, Writings by New England Millwomen, 1840 to 1845, Class Act, America's Last Dirty Secret, and Private Lives, Men and Women of the 50s, to her later biographies of Georgia O'Keeffe and Alfred Stieglitz, Lord Byron, Frederick Chopin, and George Sand, Benita has portrayed particular lives in the vivid context of their worlds. Her new book about George Catlin is no exception. George Catlin's world is that of the young Republic of the United States at its frontier, and later in the salons of England and France. We meet a man who is artist, explorer, ethnographer, showman, and writer, who spent 6 years living and painting among the Plains Indian tribes, creating what he called his Indian gallery for the use and benefit of future ages. Then, when the U.S. government failed to buy his gallery, he went into exile for more than 30 years, continuing to promote this vision abroad. He crossed paths with many of the greatest figures of his time, from Queen Victoria to King Louis-Philippe of France. He had his detractors. John James Audubon denounced his writings as trashy stuff, but his supporters outnumbered them. Jefferson Davis said, he had painted the Indian as he lives, untamed and not degraded by the contact of the white man. Charles Dickens called him an honest, hearty fellow. Charles Baudelaire believed he had brought back alive the proud and free character of these chiefs. While George Catlin was not a library member, starting in 1826, he lived for a year on Cortlandt Street, within a few blocks of the library's second home on Nassau Street. And 10 years later, when Catlin opened his Indian gallery in Clinton Hall at Nassau and Beekman, he was again just a few blocks from the library. And one more note, in order to truly enter the world of George Catlin and the libraries, we will need to turn off our cell phones. Join me in welcoming Benita Eisler to talk about George Catlin, a protean talent of paint and prose.
Good evening. What better proof could I give you that the library is and forever will be home base to me is the fact that I've just changed into my bedroom slippers. the podium being a little low and requiring a certain crouch on my part. I would also add that one is never a former trustee of the library, in the sense that my arm is still plucked by hands showing invisible signs of hypothermia, who still ask me, what can't I do something about the heating and cooling system as it turns to drops in the course of the afternoon? Not even when I was a trustee could anyone do anything about that. It is one of the many curious and, I wouldn't say lovable, but eccentricities of this marvelous building, and which will soon be all the more improved. Few people even know the true definition of the term West, George Catlin wrote, and where is its location? Phantom-like, it flies before us as we travel, and on our way is continually gilded as we approach the setting sun. This is not a Catlin. It's an original Eisler. Photograph of the Great Bend of the Upper Missouri, which Callan, in fact, did paint. I hate taking photographs, and I show you this rarity only because of my own excitement at seeing what Catlin saw in the same pristine state as when he saw it. And we, my forbearing spouse and I, climbed the same trackless wastes, only in our case bumping and grinding in an off-road vehicle, to reach the top of this very bluff, which you can see its height by the small tree. It took over 2.5 hours. And further than that, on a raft, we plowed through the same but only very muddy brown waters, not this beautiful blue, making slow progress on the same river, poling off sandbars. This is on the Montana-South Dakota border, where there is hardly a house, a telephone pole, or a car to be seen along the banks. But sadly, I was recently told that I wouldn't recognize either of these scenes as they are now pockmarked by derricks and other drilling equipment in the fracking. It's sad, but in a sense, it's also part of the ambiguity of the West, because the Indian resource person who took us there in his four-wheel drive said that he too has a profound ambivalence as to how he feels about it, because the desperation and the poverty and the social ills of the villages, the Newtown, which is the descendant of the Mandan, the Hidatsa, Arikara tribe, are in such desperate straits, and their situation is so vastly improved by the shale and the drilling. So there's the trade-off, which we all ponder in our daily readings, I would say. With eerie prescience, Catlin foresaw the layers of myth, romance, quest narrative that would soon envelop America west of the Mississippi, haunting the imagination of writers, artists, historians, explorers, seekers of adventure, of health, of gold, photographers, movie makers, misfits, and men and women who wanted only to disappear, the West having always been a beacon for that kind of fugitive. Catlin himself was all of the above, with the exception of photographer or movie maker, and he would have been both of those had he lived in the right time, full of the desire to try anything new. He's been called the first artist of the West, but what this Catlin scholar meant, of course, is that he was the first to live among as well as to paint Native Americans in their own settlements, over 32 tribes. Those who lived only along the upper Missouri. It's amazing to think that actually 32 tribes in this, not, this is north of St. Louis, going up to Fort Union. But I think it also could be added, and less frequently said certainly, that he was the first modern painter of the West. Less known for his unforgettable Indian gallery, Catlin was the great painter of emptiness. And my favorites are these weird green landscapes, of which there are many more. Their contemporary feeling is accentuated, and this is a remark made by the wonderful critic of American and 19th century arts, Sanford Schwartz of the New York, writes for the New York Review of Books, and he said what made them feel so contemporary to him was the fact that the green seems to have been squeezed straight from the tube, which is all the more remarkable since paint didn't exist in tubes. When Catlin painted, you had to mix up the pigment and put them in skins and go through all the amazing things. But these greens, and they're varied, they're numerous, and they're very strange. I think in some other context, and he has certainly been called that, they're kind of have a quality of outsider art. And indeed, he was self-taught, which I think is a sort of capacious and almost meaningless concept. It means you didn't go to an academy, but virtually everybody is self-taught, every artist. You can tell genius, I think, among other signs, because it anticipates what's around the bend. In 1928, among Catlin's wild and crazy landscapes, he did a series of paintings, eight, I believe, is the number privately owned, of Niagara Falls, and for which, very mysteriously, no one knows why, he actually took out a patent, one of the few painters to take out a patent, and no one knows under what actual circumstances, except that it does exist. As you may know, in terms of the Romantic period, starting in the very early 19th century, hordes of artists descended on Niagara. In fact, I somehow envision that easels must have jostled one another in danger of falling off the falls. And these probably were joined somewhat after the middle of the 19th century by honeymooners, or the first trickle of honeymooners. So the combination of painters and their easels and other romantics, let's say, was unique to Niagara, which is, after all, one of the wonders of the world. And besides the subject, he also did aerial views, imaginary aerial views, in which he would join, for example, the Canadian and American sides of the falls in this sort of strange, I mean, where one had the notion, unless you were Leonardo, of an aerial view was in itself extraordinary. But what I think is also amazing is that 4 years before the famous Hokusai print of The Great Wave, there's something very Asian about the frozen in time water, and even the rock formations have that quality, sort of Chinese painting in the philosophy period. His animal subjects are really portraits, and I think Goya would feel possibly a great kinship with this wounded and dying bison. He calls it the dying buffalo, who erupts with the blood that spurts to the ground from his one visible eye. I hope you can see the one blue visible eye. You see it on his tail and on the ground. Never mind that the great creature, this is very analogous to Audubon shooting thousands and thousands of birds, but Catlin shot this buffalo himself, and he dismounted from the hunt to make a preliminary sketch of the victim's last moments, and then finished him off with his own gun. It was for the portrait then says, let others be moved by compassion. The artist is a recorder of life and of death, even if he has to inflict it himself. But in this very playful, another portrait of a grizzly bear, one of two probably that Catlin owned since they were cubs, the mouse functions both to give a sense of scale. The Catlin's grizzly, probably like most of them, weighed between 800 pounds and a ton. And he is obviously there, both the mouse, that is, to give both a sense of scale and considerable humor. This is my screensaver, I want you to know, which cheers me on in low moments. He also used animals to show speed and distance. Talk about action painting. In this wonderful picture of prairie meadow burning, it's called, which is a source of horses and Indian riders gallop for their lives to escape the black engulfing smoke and flames. And here they're seen from afar, but in close-up, if you were to use a magnifying glass, the horses, which have are done with about four strokes, are infinitesimal portraits of a particular kind of horse, the small prairie horse descended from ones that the Spanish probably brought, and which also resemble individually tang horses. And you will see a little later, there's marvelous, owned by the library, volume folios of other paintings of horses and buffalo hunts, which are early and rare Catlin reproductions. And in fact, in terms of buffalo hunts, an amalgam of several of Catlin's were recreated, like the use of the Lakota language in the film Dances with Wolves, about 1977, I think this was. And it's rather typical and funny that, Hollywood's tribute to Catlin uses art to convey authenticity as opposed to the less authentic look of a Hollywood-staged buffalo hunt. But you can see the sense of authenticity in its speed and rush of a great painter. Another of the big screen pictures is called Ball Play of the Choctaw. And the Choctaw, as some may know, were the inventors of lacrosse. And I've never been able to figure out what actually is going on. But my granddaughter Leah, who is here, is a great lacrosse player, could probably tell us, is this practice? Is this tryout? Are these superstars in this kind of a Super Bowl, Super Bowl event? Are they all, as we now can see all too readily in our own contemporary athletes, are they all just self-serving, looking for stardom in a solo sense, or are they actually part of a team? But they do field enormous numbers of players, and you can see what I believe are early lacrosse sticks. Most domestic interiors were forbidden to any outsiders because of the presence of women, so that it's something of a paradox that his most controversial series of four paintings, this is one called The Cutting Scene, was of the ceremony, the man in ceremony, Okipa. It was a coming-of-age rite whose purpose was to test the courage and endurance of the most promising youth of the tribe to determine who among them would be the future leaders. At the same time, the proper fulfillment of its rituals would assure a bountiful hunt through the year to come. Earlier white visitors, including Lewis and Clark, had been allowed to witness the public rites of Okipa, including group sexual encounters at which guests were invited to participate. Lewis and Clark, however, as government agents who were there to give a report to the federal government, to President Jefferson, omitted this element from their notes, and it fell to the brilliant banker, the Philadelphia banker, Nicholas Biddle, who was their first editor, to restore all of the details of the Okipa ceremony. He does not mention whether, in fact, Catlin or other visitors, including he was a later one, took up the invitation or not, but he certainly goes into every possible detail. Before Catlin, no Anglo-European had ever been permitted to observe the ritual, which included the torture of the young. They were strung up by rawhide whips, and which were held in place by wooden splints driven into their flesh. And the rawhide whips, in sort of like a guardi-like opening in the ceiling of the circular lodge, were manipulated from above, while other torturers, as you can see, twisted and turned while they were in the splints. But this was not so much, again, the endurance was all. It was not an execution ceremony. It was a survival. It was a kind of Darwinian selection of the most fit, able, stoical, all of those qualities that were the most highly prized, and the others, well, you know, presumably didn't make it. Before Catlin, no other European had been permitted to observe this ritual, and now the artist was not merely treated as an honored guest, he was given his own studio teepee, where he transformed the rapid drawings he made during the proceedings into the more finished work you see here. It's an oil sketch. It's not finished in the sense of every feature, but is, I think, all the scarier because of that, because you see the white masks you could fairly hear the drumming and a chants that accompany that. I would only mention in terms of sound, you always kind of take that as metaphorical. Well, there was drumming and there was chanting. But until seeing recently in the Field Museum in Chicago an early film of about 1902 of Franz Boas, who reproduced on film with a soundtrack, not a soundtrack, but with phonograph recording of a shaman's proceedings, of the most blood-curdling and terrifying shrieks and screams. You would never forget it. I think the sound, you almost can't imagine that what you could see could be worse in its effect on one's dreams or nightmares than the sounds produced by the shaman. Even on this scratchy photograph, do not miss this if you're interested in anything ethnological in the otherwise dreary reinstallation of the Field Museum's treasures. You can also see why setting down more than a schematic indication of what he saw would have been very hard to do. So therein lies the utility of the studio teepee, an amazing facility to be given by Indian hosts at that point, in which in this theater it became a sort of theater of suffering. And you can see the scaffolding. It has a very theatrical quality at the same time of the horrific goings-on there. And Catlin's mention of this and the way he described it was with the most extraordinary respect of almost the distance of the ethnographer. His art, in a sense, I think, distanced the artist from the acts of ritualized violence and carnage that unfolded before his eyes. But however pagan and savage Okeepa was, he reminded himself that it was still a Mandan religious ceremony. And George Catlin, a professing Christian, entered, as he said, the great medicine house as I would have entered a church. Little did I expect, though, to see the interior of their holy temple turned into a slaughterhouse and its floor strewed with the blood of its fanatic devotees. Despite the documentary character of the series Okeepa, it dogged Catlin's career with accusations of sensationalism. It was said he exaggerated, even invented the scenes he painted for their shock value. And these were accusations that the artist, alas, seemed to confirm when he was desperate for cash in the years of his exile abroad. He published the four scenes in privately printed what was called gentleman's edition, folio reservatum, or erotica for those with special tastes, thereby undermining this was used against him, you know, for years. Every enemy brought up it was the best known folio reservatum, I think, of all of his other publications. For the better part of 6 years, Catlin had spent, this was 1831 to 1837, months at a time traveling and painting among the tribes of the northern plains. And despite all the astounding and variety and originality of his other work, the subjects we're going to see now, the portraits of the native chiefs, the braves, the wives, the squaws, the infants, mothers and children, reveals them almost demonic productivity and caused one awed critic to insist that he must have painted an Indian a day. There were 186 from one year alone, one summer, which was 1832, which is the banner year, and these are documented portraits. And here are just a few of the 186 plus in what he came to call his Indian gallery. And they're both, as you can see here, marvels of detail, especially the facial and body paint, as well as the expressive connection with the viewer. The one you saw earlier, I'm going to go back one, is Matatopa, to whom forebears, to whom Catlin owed his invitation to witness Okipa, as well as the construction of the studio, the studio in a teepee. I'm going to go back on this, sorry. There we go, there's forebears. And this is another member of the Mandan tribe who was a trophy wife. And there's Catlin, interesting enough, the ethnographer. This young woman would have been the youngest and the favorite of the polygamous chiefs of the tribe, and in which Catlin lovingly depicts her jewels, her semi-precious jewelry, which most of the other women would have had beads, and her wonderful white quilled skin robe. And the most salient aspect which fascinated every visitor to the Mandan tribe was the silvery gray hair. And in other cases, she has dark eyes, but light gray eyes. And there were endless theories. The 19th century loved theorizing and origins of curious undocumented peoples. It was a sort of period of folkloricism at its height or depth. And there were various theories. The Mandan were considered by some to be the lost tribe of Israel. And also, on the other side of the world, descendants of a legendary Welsh prince, Madoc. And they were not albino. I mean, it is a very interesting form of coloring, but they almost all had some completely silver hair. This is the most famous, the iconic Catlin portrait, Buffalo Bull's back fat. He was Blackfoot. This was actually done later than his banner year of 1932. And it has, with the marvelous quill halo, this air of divine authority defined by the feathers, and also the sort of fearful symmetry of the face cleaved by the forelock. And in a sense, he's come to stand for the Indian. But to me, this is a kind of, again, a ghettoization both of portraits of Indians, of Indian art, and even of Western art in general, because it's one of the great American portraits. That's really what you have to say. I mean, it's up there with Sully, with Benjamin West. It just happens to be of an Indian, but there's just no, you know, there's a reason why things become more popular than others in the same work of the same artist, and this is obviously a great reason why. And before leaving the realm of the fearful, this is my favorite, Catlin. It is a Blackfoot. It has the longest title as well. It's a Blackfoot medicine man practicing his magic over the body of a dying man. And happily, we don't actually see the dying man. But the medicine man may have been the artist's favorite, too, because Catlin became obsessed with owning this costume, or uniform, or garb, which you must admit is pretty snappy, with the wolf's head, the red eyes, the teeth, the long tail that goes down to the ground, and not failing to notice the high-topped red Keds. I mean, I ask you. Also, you can say that it struck. I think it could be seen as the trousers with their stripe down the side have definitely something in common with men's evening wear. I don't know when that particular convention. So it makes the red Keds all the more salient. But Catlin was so obsessed with owning this that in his own recorded notes he describes begging, trying to bribe, buy, cajole, threaten every way that he could to obtain the outfit, and finally the withholding Blackfoot medicine man sold it to him for an enormous price of several very expensive horses, which is what he obviously was holding out on all along. And he also wore it. This one would really give anything to see. He wore it lecturing when she would stand at an easel, between two easels, and two assistants would, in fact, change the pictures on this easel while Catlin held forth about the meaning and where it had taken place, all the while wearing this marvelous outfit. And the only comment made, oddly enough, you would have expected this to have been the subject of considerable speculation or at least notice, he wore it to sold-out crowds. Perhaps that was the reason for the popularity of his talks, the Stuyvesant Institute in Lower New York. The only comment made was simply that he was wearing an Indian costume, and this was in Philadelphia. The only newspaper comment on the costume did not go into any description, simply that the lecturer wore an authentic Indian costume with a frisbee, definitely. All of this popularity in the sense of sold out lectures, endless reviews were marvelous. He had not the attendees who included all of the great and the good of every city, including the indefatigable diarist Philip Hone, William Seward, the mayors. I mean, everyone turned out. It was the place to be. You had to go. But at the same time, it brought in no money. And he never was interested in private commissions. I mean, his subjects were not of the sort that commissioned. He had been a failure as a society portraitist, again in Philadelphia, where those who were practiced the grand style, as he said, there were many who were first before him, to say the least. That was not his métier at all. So he made numerous, time and time again, unsuccessful attempts, as Jenny mentioned, to sell his work to what should have been a grateful nation. And time and again, he failed to do so. And the reason, and there were several, but one came from his complete lack of any political sense whatsoever, and being also a very poor judge of character. And among the political, if he'd had some political sense of what was going on, as in the tensions that were mounting over the slavery issue, what the veto that always came in his near misses, I mean, they were tragically always a couple of votes short, came from the fact that the subject of Indians was seen as proximate to abolitionism, so that the Southern senatorial bloc, including admirers, open admirers of Catlin's art like Henry Clay, who said he was a great, great artist, but he could not, which he did not say, he could not politically afford to vote because the swing states, the slave states that hoped to be, were very concerned about where these were going, how these issues were going to be settled. So in the famous case of Georgia versus the Cherokee tribe, the notion that any federal patronage or favor would go to a painter of Indians was tantamount to the federal government tipping in one direction or another. And it seems from at least his voluminous writings and his disappointment and his efforts that he never got that very basic political fact. At least he never alludes to any. He could always said he could see no reason how this could possibly fail. I mean, there was a kind of blindness as to what the political ramifications of his Indian advocacy, or at least the portraiture as seen as Indian advocacy. So late in 1839, Catlin set sail for England, where he'd hoped, having heard of great royal collectors, including the royal family itself, but many aristocratic, famous aristocratic collections, he had hoped to benefit from the fact that their largesse didn't just cover portraits of one another or forebears, but everyone then, as now, was fascinated by the American West. There were many English aristos who had done the grand tour in reverse, there was, in fact, a recent book on those English who settled, as in darkest Africa, wearing evening clothes on the frontier, somewhat evil in war in spirit, in various forts along the Missouri River. So he set off for England, accompanied by two assistants, one of whom was his nephew. The two grizzly bears lodged unhappily in specially built cages on the deck of the ship Roscius, and hundreds of boxes of his paintings and Indian artifacts in the hold. And his long-suffering wife followed a year later with their little girl, the only one of his four children to be born in America. Her father would not see his native country for 31 years, while her mother was never to return home, dying of pneumonia in Paris in 1845. And Catlin's years abroad, both in England and the continent, in France and in Brussels, were years of wandering. In the course of three decades of self-exile, he's held to have changed, and not for the better, from artist to showman, touring two troops of Indians from the Iowa and Ojibwa tribes, the length and breadth of England, Ireland, Scotland. And at the same time, he's been seen as suffering a moral decline and even a sort of degeneration, shifting from the Indians' advocate to their exploiter. And as is usually the case in human affairs, neither of these is completely true or completely false. As to his giving up painting for showing and managing his Indian tribes, who reenacted dances and buffalo hunts and tribal warfare very effectively, he was active as a painter in Paris. This is one of his Iowa troupe painted in Paris, one of the great portraits that he did. And in fact, this portrait of a performer, but also of a tribal man called Running Dancer, was a conversion event when the Catlin show was a selection of his work was at the National Portrait Gallery last March in London. And because it got huge, I mean, the crowds were enormous, the attendance was terrific, and the press coverage as an event was sensational, except with typical sort of English snootiness about all American art, except if it was painted yesterday, there was a sense that it was an event, but that the art was, of course, nothing much to speak of. But one convert, who was an acquaintance of ours, found this picture so shattering, as he described it, it was absolutely terrifying, which I think the English, as inventors of the Gothic, love nothing more than to be terrified, and this was taken finally as a recognition that it's only a great artist who can terrify. But the hands, I mean, it's the only instance I can think of where the hands, there's representational face painting. Mostly it's symbolic, referring to battles or one's prowess. But the two hands, there's another one on the other side, which come together, suggesting that one is the wearer is either about to garrote enemies or inflict some other awful form of death. But it is just an extraordinary, it is absolutely terrifying, in fact. Are you going to? Oh, thank you. Not only do certain spouses bring your slippers, but they actually provide you with drinks of water. Thank you very much. This is actually called Fast Dancer. I got the name wrong. This is also done in Paris of an Iowa mother and child. And one of the other mothers and her son died in the course of the trip, the arduous trip from Dundee, Scotland to Paris. First this 3.5-year-old child died, and then his mother died of tuberculosis, who became a sort of heroine. I'm sorry? Thank you for mentioning it. Are we more audible? Great, thanks. This to me is not only possibly the influence of seeing a lot of European art. Catlin had a chance. I mean, American museums were in their infancy, and I think Catlin had very little chance to see European art of earlier periods. And I think that's obviously a Native American Madonna and child, but it's also, I think, has the quality of a mourning picture. Because it was not only the Iowa mother and child who within months of each other died, but in a horrible instance of symmetry or mirroring of tragedy, Catlin's wife died in Paris suddenly, and his only son, the youngest of his four children, died of either meningitis or typhoid, or one of those awful things, months later. So there's the sense of a mother, a parent and child, which is not to me so much an Indian portrait as a mourning picture. The father of the dead child and his wife, Little Wolf, was the star of the Iowa troupe. And it's always been shown Catlin's letter decrying the absence of his star performer, the handsomest and best dancer of the troupe, has always been taken to show his growing callousness. He had become another Barnum with whom he partnered in several disastrous business ventures in their show business careers. I think Barnum got thoroughly sick of Catlin's lack of business sense. But it's held that he, in the course of becoming a showman, that he took on all of the most unhappy and callous aspects of the show must go on. But in fact, at this point, his desperation in terms of finances was such that my growing sense of sympathy was that he simply could not afford to allow himself further worries and greater sympathy. I mean, or he would have probably just unglued completely. And I think this tribute to the Little Wolf, the great Iowa star, indeed, with all of his bear claws and medals. These are presidential medals of silver and gold. All of his Indian male portraits, by the way, which you may have noticed, have presidential medals, which were kind of handouts, not to sound too cynical, for all the land that was being taken away. When delegations of Indians went to Washington, they all got a silver medal at the very least. If you were top of the tribe or heap, you might have gotten a gold one, but there is perhaps his performing skills, but there is Little Wolf with his medals and his bear claws. And there's so much sympathy in the portrait that I think it's a kind of compensation of mutual loss, of admiration, of perhaps apology or sadness. But there's such a sense of the sadness of this performer, and I don't think you could do that if you just had a sense of the feelings about his loss to you of the gate, so to speak, by not appearing. As soon as the Revolution of 1848 broke out, Catlin, because of his royal patronage, he was commissioned, finally one of his few commissions, came from King Louis-Philippe, which was a series of La Salle. Louis-Philippe was one who had done the grand tour in reverse, and he had a huge admiration for the American West, and he wanted a series that portrayed the scenes in the life of the great evangelizer of La Salle. So that Catlin did that. But then his royal affiliations made it essential that he flee along with the monarchs and their innumerable Orléans relations. And on his flight, taking nothing, he stored the pictures that he had done in Paris, which is why they're so well preserved, and fled with his three little girls to London, where in 1949 they're awaited, 1849, moving him into the present, there awaited him creditors, bailiffs, and ultimately debtors' prison. But in terms of the portraits of, this is the only known self-portrait, which is the frontispiece of the book that he wrote and was published in London in 1841, almost shortly after he arrived, self-published, needless to say, adding to his vast debts. And what is so wonderfully English is he shows himself in Sherlock Holmes' Deerstalker, painting in an Indian village the same forebears in Matatopa. Obviously a very jaunty tribute to his hosts. He was invited when in London in happier days to all kinds of shooting parties and weekends, very sort of proto-Edwardian in style. So there he is, ready for the hunt, but not in the West anymore, but an anglicized version. And this is a close-up of Catlin in Deerstalker, ready for another set of gilt-edged invitations, painting with the villagers all grouped around in admiration as they watch him. In the famous lines of Dante, that there is no greater despair than to recall past happiness. This is the portrait of Catlin Dunn in the 1850s when he is, I think it's actually 1849, when he has just emerged from debtor's prison, and he clearly wanted to be portrayed. This is by a, you know, not very fascinating Royal Academy artist, but it's Catlin as he wanted to be seen and wanted to be remembered and wanted others to see him. It's a very strange and interesting portrait with the couple, sort of shadowy couple, who he's about to paint in there. It's all imaginary, all hearkening back to his glory days of triumph in the depths of his most miserable life, and he didn't know what was going to become of him. And talk about remembering past triumphs. There is the scene of his greatest one, in which you don't see him except as a group. There are the monarchs, Louis-Philippe and his queen, and the Iowa. This is a great reception in the Tuileries. The Iowa there in their performance, seated to the admiration of the royals. He didn't paint this, so you can call it an exercise in nostalgia, but certainly the great portrait, which is always shown, the official portrait of Catlin in his remembrance of things past in their happiest sense, is certainly one of nostalgia. And this is finally Catlin in the age of photography. It's amazing to me to think, I always am startled by this, that someone born, a man born in 1796, lives to have a photograph taken, and actually a marvelous daguerreotype. And it also struck me that looking at him, it's 4 years before his death, they say the camera never lies, but today it lies all the time, of course, with Photoshop. And before there was Photoshop, there was airbrushing. And even now when you get contact prints, you see the whitening out of things that you're probably pleased to have whitened out, usually. But the camera did not lie in its early stages. In fact, because of the very slow process of daguerreotype, people often looked more harried or sometimes downright crazed, simply having to sit still that period of time. But this is a portrait also of Catlin, the stoical Yankee, showing the signs already of the liver and heart disease that was going to kill him, with his hollow eyes and pained gaze. And clearly, he was offered, most daguerreotypes are of seated subjects, and he was clearly offered the chair, the empty chair, and insisted on standing up, even though he needed a cane. And there's something in that picture that makes me think of the great Aiken's portraits of standing, and very often also very despondent and melancholy subjects. Just who was the man, I often ask when you were working for a number of years on a biography, behind these many lives and prodigious number of paintings, the overachieving, under-rewarded, perpetually optimistic failure, the explorer, ethnologist, inventor, and writer. One of the great rewards of the biographer is finding a subject who is still a blank canvas. This may not fill the coffers as rapidly as presidents and athletes, but it's lots more fun, at least in my view, that when you're working on them. And with Catlin, who left the most enormous and rich paper trail, even the documentation by him and others is always seems to me a smokescreen to conceal an inner life and possibly aspects of his private life as well. I'm especially grateful that this artist's relative obscurity promised both little competition in other work. There were more gnarled hands reaching for boxes of Byron material. In Catlin's case, you could just blow the dust off the boxes at the Archives of American Art. They greeted you with beaming smiles, because so, other than, since you particularly weren't working on your genealogy, thrilled to have somebody do something with something that's the first collection that was microfilmed in the 40s, when microfilm, alas, was in its infancy. I'm not sure it's progressed that much, but in any case, it was their first one. And the other aspect of his life that I'm even more grateful about is that there is no Catlin cult. And I have to tell you, this is the most happy contrast to the first biography that I did on Georgia O'Keeffe, who I had never realized was the object of cults innumerable, and that if you are still unlucky enough to go to Santa Fe, either on the anniversary of her birth or death or something like that, there are candlelight vigils in honor of Georgia. And in the various sort of readings and promotion and signings that I did, it never failed that they were, first of all populated, seemingly, by hollow-eyed young women, and at one of whom stood up one day evening and announced to me, I think it was in Berkeley, "I don't care," she said, "what you've discovered about Georgia. Georgia talks to me in my dreams. I know what she thinks and has done and is thinking." Well, I can happily say I have never talked to George Catlin in my dreams, and I've yet to meet anyone who claims to have done so. With no privileged communication from the beyond, many mysteries about his life, my research notwithstanding, remain. But I would say that despite research and what I have found and other discoveries, my most thrilling discovery was just how great and original an artist, and how courageous and poignant and with much greatness the man he was. And for that revelation, and for those revelations, I should say, George Catlin may be said to have acquired a cult of one, his biographer. Thank you. Would anyone care to ask questions? Yes.
What got you from Byron and Joyce to Catlin?
Like many others for whom he was actually a name, I saw, visiting my best friend in Washington, the Great Catlin Show of 2004. Which reestablished or recreated, I think one would say, in the Corcoran Gallery, almost all of his original Indian Gallery, which is where it was shown when it was donated by the widow of one of his creditors. The irony of this man's life are just never ending. Unable to sell anything any time in his lifetime, the whole collection was taken. He was sort of rescued by giving an IOU for the whole shooting works to a Philadelphia industrialist, a boiler maker, a boiler manufacturer, and who also asked much too high a price for the new Smithsonian, who passed on it. And then his widow, Harrison's widow, gave it to the Smithsonian, where it was hung very much as the show of 2004, which also toured in much truncated form. I was so knocked out by those pictures, and most of them were not very well hung, and because they hung in that style of heavy hanging and many layers. But even what you could see, and the National Portrait Gallery show in London, you could see them for the first time. And the more you see them, the greater you realize they are. They are simply unbelievable. And I think, to answer the question, I've realized that so little was known about him, and it was all contradictory, and there had not been a Catlin biography but for a sort of fictionalized one of those sort of semi-novelistic biographies from 1949, and there had been absolutely nothing. A lot of scholarly and interesting work on their endless watercolor albums and endless boring drawings and all. But that's really where the work has been, to try to sort out the oeuvre. But the biography project just tempted me from the moment I realized that nobody had gone there. Yes. Angela.
Did Catlin witness or record any of the Indian removals? I'm just thinking of de Tocqueville at Memphis in 1832, watching the Choctaws go across the river and recording their horrific condition.
It's a most unbelievably and horrible, and so simply written, the de Tocqueville. No, he did not, because he really went... I wouldn't say invited would be precious, but he really was interested in that rather narrow area, and then with a younger man who may or may not have been his lover, but who went with him as a draftsman. He went on an expedition to the now what would be around Tulsa, the Arkansas Territory. And that was actually as far afield. There was his first encounter with non-Upper Missouri Indians. So there he saw, I think that was probably the Choctaw, Chickasaw. It would be the Oklahoma area. But that was his only foray outside of the upper Missouri. And I think, oddly enough, going along with his lack of political sense, he was sympathetic and, I think, an earnest advocate for Indians. He knew all about the removal and the fact that the land grabs were much the subject, because his first mentor was General Clark of Lewis and Clark fame, and he really was Clark's protege. He was allowed to sit in on council meetings, and Clark was the consummate diplomat. Everyone left the table feeling he had won, and in the meantime, nobody won. It was the U.S. government who won, always, so that everyone went away satisfied. He spoke 8 or 9 Indian languages, and that was another interesting guy. Catlin ended his life completely deaf. And I think it was probably a deafness that began at a much earlier point. He never learned a single Indian tongue, when many people, I mean, just ordinary fur traders, Clark again, spoke 8 or 9 completely different Indian languages, which were essential if you worked and lived on the Upper Missouri. He learned not a word of French or any other foreign tongue that anybody's ever known. And I think it possibly is a hearing issue, or simply an inability to learn languages. But that, too, had a separating effect. He was there as a painter. He was sympathetic. He wrote about the vanishing race. But there was also a sense of sort of fatality about it as well. Yes?
What happened to his children?
His children were adopted. He was sprung, as it were, from debtor's prison by his very rich brother-in-law, the whole Dudley family, Gregory family, who was his wife's, his in-laws were rich Albany burghers. And as rich as the father was, his brother-in-law, Dudley Gregory, who became mayor of Jersey City and a state and a congressman, and in a day when the notion of conflict of interest simply did not exist, you were there to clean up. I mean, if you had any. So as well off, yeah, Jersey City. Well, let's not make rude remarks about Jersey City. But it does seem to have. In any case, Douglas Gregory became a kind of minor robber baron. And less out of sympathy for Catlin is that when his sister was alive, he did not want undue hardship falling on the family, and he had these 3 little nieces. So when Catlin was sent off to Queen's Bench debtor's prison, Dudley Gregory appeared as fast as possible, and with their father's, I think, regretful permission, took off the 3 little girls back to Jersey City, where they joined his 14 other children, poor, long-suffering Mrs. Gregory, and presumably given the kind of bourgeois life, he was a pillar of the community. He also provided a place for Catlin to come and die, which was required by a Victorian ethos. But it usually implies that there's the sort of death scene, which I sometimes love to read. I don't like reading generally, and I read very badly. But the Victorian death scene requires that the father, the dying parent, is surrounded by his loving children and raises his hand in benediction. But for Dudley Gregory, he felt he'd done enough, and he lodged the dying Catlin in one of his many properties, the Hotel Darcy, where he was allowed to die, presumably attended by daughters, but not probably by his brother-in-law. You know, the Christian charity has its limits. But in any case, that was Catlin's death at the Hotel Darcy in Jersey City, which in fact claimed him for one of its own. It wrote a wonderful, the best obituary. He'd been completely forgotten by the time he came back here, which was 2 years before his death. But the Jersey City Times eulogized him as the great man that he was. So let's hear it for Jersey City, not only of robber barons and small-time entrepreneurs. Yes.
Anything, did he see them? Were they happy?
It's a wonderful question, and it's answered in part or by inference, let's say, that they, when he was at Fort Union in the banner year of 1832 in the summer, he was given not a teepee, but one of the fort's four bastions. He had a circular studio where the tribes who gathered there, and they were numerous, came from their surrounding villages to trade furs and whatnot for Western, for American goods, pots and pans and domestic artifacts in exchange for hides, particularly, and beaver skins. And they lined up on the stairs from the ground floor to the second floor of the bastion where Catlin was painting, and it became the portrait with all the regalia, the war trophies, the tomahawks frequently, as in the case of the Buffalo Bull. It became an enormous status symbol to be painted by Catlin. They did not, to my knowledge, because the ones that survived suggest that it wasn't so much that they perhaps wanted to own them as to have it done. I mean, I think the ownership was less, I'm not sure anybody really wanted to put a Catlin, even of themselves, on the wall of their lodge, which were in any case communal, filled with smoke. So I think the fact of being painted was like the Medal of Honor. I mean, it was, everyone knew you and they recognized, the fact that you were recognizable was of course the major thing. It was unbelievable. It was in fact magic. And he was given the honorary title of Medicine Man, which was a source of great pride to the painter. I mean, how many painters do you know would qualify even portraitists? But I don't think, there's no record, for example, of any of his portraits even remaining in the area, other than a couple commissioned by Clark's son-in-law, Major O'Fallon. But there's no record that any Indian work. There's a wonderful record, though. There's something to be mentioned. There's so many things I would keep you here forever. Is the collaborative work of forebears, Matatopa, who was a tribal artist, and Catlin, who each contributed, Catlin doing pictographs, like I said, this act of early appropriation art. Catlin did pictographs along with forebears on an enormous cape, which is still in the Smithsonian, a cloak. And there it's documented. And you can see the kind of imitation that you see Catlin's hand imitating the natural representational style of the man, and it is fascinating. And if you're willing to make 18 phone calls and write 12 letters, you could make an appointment, possibly. They're very nervous about appropriation by tribal, of all tribal art is now sacred. So no fishing expeditions. You have to know exactly what you want to see and tell them exactly why you want to see it. Even though it's your tax money and mine that maintain these collections, they are so nervous about, there's a reappropriation desk at the main area of the Smithsonian, but this place, where the Indian material is located, they bus you out in unmarked white vans with all your decked out and IDs and all the stuff. So in any case, it was worth it. I don't know whether it would be to you, but it was a really amazing experience. Yes?
Did he write Shut Your Mouth? Is it true?
In his invention, that's a whole other story. Catlin's inventions are staggering, and his visionary ideas, such as a floating museum of mankind, an ethnological museum, that would represent tribal art and its creators and examples, human wearers, bearers of all this. And it was to float around all of the places where the tribal peoples would have come from, I mean, a kind of Samoa, and never, I mean, just touch land and to take on people to come to lectures. I mean, it's just an extraordinary idea, a kind of, you know, the cruise ships, like the Nation Cruise, you know, very uplifting and lots of conversation. You meet very nice people, et cetera, but it unfortunately did not, as they get off the ground or off the water. But he also had inventions for the shipwrecks, which were so common at that period, even in the early steamship days. And his wife, poor woman on many respects, was terrified of drowning at sea. And he had an idea for lifeboat that detached from the hull of a steamship. It just, in when you were about to be the Titanic, it just, instead of being a miserable lifeboat, the whole hull, the outer part of the hull, detached and off you floated in a smaller, big boat. I mean, his inventions, and he always, with the will to fail like no one else you have ever read about, always managed to get the wrong patent officer to get, you know, to write, who disappeared, or at someone else in time for someone else to make get the patent. Anyway, it was always disastrous, and nothing ever worked out. But the Shut Your Mouth, this was one of his seemingly very, it's the title of the book, which this gentleman knows all about. One of his theories was that if you slept with your mouth closed, that you would thereby, my husband's having hysterics. I thought you knew all about this. Well, if you read the book, you see that's how you catch out your mate. You see, this is a totally exposure of the Osler marriage for all to hear about. The theory is that if you slept with your mouth closed, that the germs would not enter, or whatever past your illness could not possibly afflict you with it. Everyone would, and you had to sleep on your back. But what's very interesting is the infant death syndrome, which now maintains that it is essential in terms of breathing, particularly for young children and particularly males, is not to allow them to sleep on their chest or stomach. So probably, as with many, he probably had something there. We could try, as these apnea centers now presumably save lives by curing snoring and all this. Maybe there's we can start a Catlin Shut Your Mouth Center. I think we're all getting goofy. And a final question or two before we part. It's been so much fun talking with you. Yes. Cody came, obviously, 30 years later. Well, the main difference is, I don't mean to sound giggly, is that Cody was a huge success and Catlin was a failure. I mean, I think there are so many reasons. But I think there was also, Cody had business managers and was very savvy, a la Barnum. I mean, there's a tradition of showmen that just couldn't fail. Barnum, with all the hokum, et cetera, had something that he had a pulse on novelty. He knew what people wanted to see. And I think Cody also, with his tribes of horses and the acts that he produced, were just, I mean, from Queen Victoria on, I mean, everyone had to see the Wild West show. Other than that, I mean, the analogies in career, Cody and Barnum are what Catlin would have wanted to be, but could never figure out how it worked. Yes. Thank you. Thanks very much.
I just want to remind everyone we do have books for sale outside, and Benita is willing to sign at the front.